Welcome to the Sydney J. Friedberg Lecture on Italian Art. In his lecture, presented on December 8, 2019, Gabriele Finaldi of the National Gallery London discusses Mantegna's particular universe as constructed in stone, carved, cut, polished, and sometimes invented. In his compelling imaginarium, the ancient world is a severe construct of marble, alabaster, and porphyry. He juxtaposes sculpted stone with flesh, creating potent dualities of ancient and modern, eternal and transient, dead and alive. In the skies of his paintings, clouds take on mysterious forms, sometimes rock-like, that want to insinuate themselves into his narratives. This lecture explores how the realms of nature, art, and antiquity are fused into the unique vision of Mantegna's Renaissance world.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm here with my wife, Maria Inez, who's never visited Washington before, and she is absolutely thrilled to be here. It's fantastic to be in the National Gallery of Art, and I can see how amazing things have happened since I was last here, and I'm sure with Kaywin, fantastic things are going to happen also in the future. When the 17th century Flemish painter David Teniers made his copy of Mantegna's St. Sebastian in order to make a printed illustration of it for publication in the catalogue of the masterpieces in the collection of the Archduke Leopold William, governor of the Netherlands. That was a catalogue that was called the Teatrum Pictorium and was first published around 1660. He left out many of the things that we find most interesting in Mantegna's original. The abundance and sharpness of the details were obviated. The signature carved in the architecture is not there. The different characteristics of the stone that form the sculptural elements is hardly alluded to. And one of the most intriguing features is absent altogether, the image of the rider in the clouds. I suppose the artistic temperament of the two artists could hardly be more different. The irritation we might feel as we compare copy and original is eclipsed, however, when we turn our focus solely on Mantegna's original. A painting of consummate pictorial mastery, astounding in its invention and technical skill. The presence of the small panel in London for the Mantegna and Bellini exhibition that Elizabeth referred to just a moment ago in the autumn winter of 2018 provided the opportunity to become reacquainted with it and to admire it once again. Many things are impressive about it. Here are a few. It's been recently pointed out that the combination of upturned head and polyclitean contrapposto in the pose constitutes a new beginning in the iconography of pain, nearly two generations before the discovery of the Laocoon in 1506. Mantegna offers us a compelling vision of antiquity through the representation of the sculpted elements of the arch and the fragments of friezes and sculptures scattered on the left side of the composition. The gilt metal capital is a pictorial invention of Mantegna's, for nothing as elaborate or exquisite as this was known from the ancient world, or indeed from Mantegna's own time. The broken arch on the left, with its brick interior, shows just the feet of the victory figure, who is seen complete on the right. One Nike has been defeated by the passage of time, another remains triumphant. The flesh and blood feet of Sebastian, the Christian martyr, victorious through his faith, are eloquently juxtaposed with a broken marble sandaled Roman foot, the first living, the second petrified, paralyzed. This is the rhetoric of the new order having succeeded the old. Mantegna repeats the juxtaposition even more expressively in the Louvre Saint Sebastian of some two decades later. But it is notable that in neither case does he appear to express a strong personal moral preference in favor of one or the other. Ironically, the image of the old order had to be carefully reconstructed by Mantegna in order for it to be destroyed in the interests of a triumphant Christianity. The antique arch in the Vienna picture has had to be broken in order to reveal the artist's signature, which is written in Greek letters to the left of the saint. Te ergon to Andro. This is the work of Andrea. The inscription, as you can see, continues behind the carved marble plaster, but we can read no more. Mantegna constructs and Mantegna destroys. It's all his own work. But I want to focus on the cloud figure, one of the most distinctive elements of the painting, Pace 10 Years, and what it tells us about Mantegna's interests and priorities as an artist. The rider you can see is at upper left. He appears to be bearded, although it has been said that he is naked. This seems difficult to affirm. Only the horse's forequarters are shown with part of the area of the saddle. This is not an image of a horseman riding on a cloud, but the image itself is made out of clouds. Paul Cristella, in 1901, in his great monograph on Mantegna, suggested a specific visual source, and that is the medieval relief sculpture that appears on the facade of the Church of San Zeno in Verona, showing the Ostrogothic king Theodoric hunting deer. In spite of the similarity being only generic, this proposal has enjoyed some support. The relief would certainly eventually have been known to Mantegna as he painted the high altarpiece of the church at a later date. The notion of the image made by chance, encapsulated in the phrase natura artifex, can be traced back to antiquity when various writers allude to it. Pliny the Elder, in his Natural History, refers to an agate stone that with no human intervention appeared to show Apollo and the Muses. And he mentions an image of Silenus becoming visible to some stonecutters in the natural striations of a block of Parian marble which they had just opened. Aristophanes, in his comedy The Clouds, evokes the ability of clouds to take on whatever form they please, centaur, wolf, leopard, bull, or woman. And Aristotle, in his De Somnis, on dreams, compares changing dreams with clouds which can rapidly transform themselves into the form of human beings or centaurs. Cicero, too, when observing how chance can imitate reality, asked rhetorically, "Have you never noticed the form of a lion or centaur in the clouds?" Later medieval sources also refer to cloud images. Michael Psello, in his 11th century treatise on demons, uses the metaphor of the changing shape of clouds, in his words, which take the appearance and form now of men, now of bears, now dragons, and now other kinds of animals, to explain how evil spirits can take on any form they choose. The pareidolian dialogue, pareidolian is the technical term of the stimulus that inclines people to see recognizable forms in inanimate objects. The pareidolian dialogue between Hamlet and Polonius, I'm sure is well known to you. It's a celebrated example of witnessing cloud apparitions. Hamlet, do you see yonder cloud that's almost in the shape of a camel? Polonius, by the mass, and 'tis like a camel indeed. Hamlet, methinks it's a weasel. Polonius, it is backed like a weasel. Hamlet, or a whale, very like a whale. Today there are numerous online sites and Facebook groups. There really is one for everyone. That gather together cloud images, and I assure you there are some weird and wonderful things to be found there. Stags and witches. Tickly baby bears, and the apparition of a male member in the sky that a few years ago shocked some of the good people of Derbyshire, according to the Daily Mirror. But before we stray too far, let's try and get closer to Mantegna's interest in cloud images again. In canvas 3 of the Triumphs of Caesar, Bearers of Trophies and Bullion, a cloud head appears at upper right, reminiscent of the face of the man on the moon that is sometimes found in crucifixion images when the sun and moon are shown either side of the cross. Although it has been said that because this canvas has been so heavily manipulated by subsequent restoration, this image is not reliable, my impression is that the head fits into a pattern of cloud inventions that Mantegna deployed in his paintings over the course of his career. In regard to this specific example, it's useful to cite a late 14th century text by Biagio Pellacani from Parma, who in his Questiones Perspectivae, in the chapter dedicated to apparentiae, a category that includes images created by atmospheric refraction, refers to a cloud apparition that had been witnessed in Lombardy on 3 successive days of a marching army with cavalry and infantry bearing ensigns and lances. He explains that this image in the sky was produced by particular atmospheric conditions that projected the appearance of some marching Milanese troops into the clouds. This reference is not gratuitous here, because Pellacani was the teacher of Giovanni da Fontana, a Venetian physician and mathematician, who wrote a treatise on perspective in the early 1450s, dedicated to none other than Jacopo Bellini, Mantegna's father-in-law. Giovanni da Fontana specifically mentions this passage in his treatise and has himself some pertinent observations to make on cloud images. In writing about colors and their ability to increase or diminish the illusion of distance, he refers to clouds, which, when they are dense, take on the appearance of rocky formations with caves and caverns. This occurs, he explains, because those parts which are darker are perceived by the eye as being further away. We will come to Mantegna's caves in due course. But all of this indicates that in Mantegna's circle, cloud images were not just in the air, as it were, but being specifically written about and discussed. Here, for example, in the 1497 Trivulzio Madonna by Mantegna, heads of putti, constructed of clouds, gather around the image of the Virgin to ornament her mandorla of light. The bubbling, billowing cloud throws up the form of heads, which one can imagine appearing and disappearing in constantly changing configurations. Some of the cloud heads are in the process of being transformed into flesh and blood heads. There are other examples of this kind of angelic shape-shifting in some of his other Madonnas, but this is the most elaborate and eloquent example in Mantegna's work. We will return to Mantegna's rider and to other cloud images in his work in a moment. But first, I wanted to look at some other examples of their use by other 15th century artists. First, the earliest example that I have seen cited in the modern literature is in the Giottesque scene of the death of St. Francis in the upper church at Assisi, in which the saint's soul is shown being taken up to heaven on a cloud while his body lies on a bier mourned by Franciscan friars. Chiara Frugoni, in a 2007 article in the Burlington Magazine, drew attention to a form that appears on the right side of the cloud, which resembles a head in profile. She is inclined to see some horns on the head and identifies it as the head of a demon. Psellus's comments that I cited earlier come to mind. She admits that it's not easy to spot, and one may even argue that these are random arrangements of dark and light into which she has subjectively read a human head. And in a sense, that is precisely the point. These random images thrown up by nature insinuate themselves into the perception of the viewer and can be read as nothing, as something, or as different things to different people, just as the Shakespearean dialogue previously quoted suggests. Be that as it may, here are some examples closer to Mantegna's time in which the artist's intention is, I believe, unmistakable. The so-called Master of the Argonauts, in his Cupid and Psyche panels in Berlin, has depicted clouds taking the form of the signs of the zodiac. Here, Sagittarius and Capricorn. And in the pendant panel, the sky is peopled with a woman blowing a horn and various dragons made out of cloud stuff. The courtly and elegant Fra Carnevale introduces a cloud dolphin into his Birth of the Virgin in the Metropolitan Museum. It is a playful and almost furtive inclusion and is not easy to spot. I've had a very close look at your Annunciation here by Fra Carnevale, but there doesn't seem to be anything of that kind going on in that picture. In Signorelli's Education of Pan, this picture was destroyed in the war, a cloud horseman appears by the head of the older shepherd standing to the left of Pan. The elaborate iconography of the painting, almost certainly commissioned by Lorenzo de' Medici at the beginning of the 1490s, has usually been interpreted in a Neoplatonic key, with the flying horse and rider signifying the soul as it liberates itself from its earthly bonds and proceeds to the ethereal realm. Lorenzo de' Medici himself had something to say about cloud forms in his Commento d'alcuni sonetti d'amore, written in about 1476, 77.
Vedesi ancora, per esempio di questo, qualche volta nelle nubi aeree diverse strane forme d'animale e di uomini.
Sometimes one may see in heavenly clouds diverse and strange forms of animals and men.
Leonardo da Vinci describes in his notes for a treatise on painting how, if you look carefully at clouds, or at stains on the wall, or cinders in a fire, or even at muds and soils, you will find there most admirable inventions, which will spur the ingenuity of the artist to new inventions, and to such compositions of battles, animals, and men, as well as landscapes and monstrous things such as devils and the like, that they will bring you great honor. For out of confused things, the painter's ingegno awakes to new inventions. This fascinating passage goes quite a lot further than some of the earlier comments I have cited in making the connection between the recognition of random forms in nature and their use as an inspiration or kickstarter for the artist's own imagination. Nature, herself an artist, spurs the painter on to make great works of art. Or natura artifex, artem inspirat, to coin a Latin motto. I've not found anyone saying that in the Renaissance, but they should have. Leonardo, of course, takes us to the theoretical uplands of Renaissance thinking on the arts. But here, before we return to Mantegna, are a couple of curious cloud images in the work of Marco Palmizzano, a painter from Forlì, who clearly had a strong propensity for seeing things in the sky. Here in his Virgin and Child with Saints, we can see Pegasus, another leaping quadruped, and an angel formed out of cloud substance, making their appearance in the sky above the holy gathering. In his way to Calvary, two vapor angels appear in the stratocumulus in the heavens. Millard Meiss in 1957 thought that Mantegna's horseman was simply a visual pun, one form signifying another with no meaning beyond that of an aesthetic jeu d'esprit. Other authors thought that the figure was to be understood as a deity of time, that's Mirella Levi d'Ancona, or a demon or angel of eschatological meaning, Battisti. But curiously, perhaps, no link with the iconography of Sebastian was proffered. The question is, does the cloud rider have to be understood as an integrated part of the meaning of the painting, or is it simply a skillful and surreptitious demonstration of Mantegna's familiarity with classical sources? The latter is possible, but the former would seem more logical. Some more recent interpretations have gone to the most obvious source which Mantegna is likely to have turned to for this, as indeed for other religious works, Jacopo da Voragine's compilation of Lives of the Saints, The Golden Legend. In giving the etymology of Sebastian's name, Voragine states, "Nam miles Christus, equus ecclesia, bastum sive cella Sebastianus. Christ is the soldier, the horse is the church, Sebastian is the saddle." Without needing to firmly identify the cloud horseman in Mantegna's painting as Christ himself, the image conjured up out of vapor can be readily interpreted as an allusion to Sebastian the soldier. The early history of this painting remains unknown, but it has been suggested, quite plausibly, that it could be the operetta, the small work, which in 1459, Mantegna is known to have been making for a Venetian general called Jacopo Marcello, who had close links to Mantegna's Paduan humanist friends, and he is known to have had an interest in classical reliefs and inscriptions, examples of which he owned. The association between this painting and the soldier Sebastian, and indeed Jacopo Marcello, I think is readily made. There's nothing to confirm it, but it's a useful hypothesis. In his late and complex allegory made for Isabella d'Este, Marquise of Mantua, Minerva chasing the vices from the Garden of Virtue in 1500-1502, the sky is populated with cloud heads. And perhaps more than have been explicitly identified until now. This painting was the second picture that Mantegna made for the Marquise of Mantua's studiolo in the Castello of San Giorgio, and it shows the goddess of wisdom expelling a motley crew of mostly grotesque personifications of the vices from a garden which they have overrun. Here, the clouds puff themselves into a crude profile of a head with deep-set eye, a boxer's nose, and fleshy lips. Behind it, like an echo, is another head in profile, which repeats the nose and thick lips. But before you even had time in your mind to confirm that these are not simply random forms that we have wished into the shape of human heads, another profile appears to emerge from the same cloud bank, but looking in the opposite direction, in a dark cumulus cloud face-off. A less menacing, more childlike cloud profile appears lower down in the sky, billowing itself into existence above the orange trees. And facing it, in the opposite direction, in another cloud bank, further to the right, at about the same height, another head, satyr-like, possibly, with what looks like a goatee beard. This abundance of cloud figures seems appropriate in a painting which includes a host of grotesque and chimerical creatures, personifications of the vices, monsters of nature. The subject provided the opportunity for Mantegna's ingegno to be awoken and for natural forms to be transformed by his invention. An anthropomorphic olive or laurel tree on the left of the garden addresses the three virtues in the sky who approach on a cloud float. Come, divine companions of the virtues, the inscription says in Latin, who are returning to us from heaven. Expel these foul monsters of vices from our seats. The rightward thrust of the composition engages not only the figures, but also the clouds and the dramatic orange rock formation that climbs into the sky as if it were wanting to take part in the rout. The shadow line that runs along the craggy mountain, where there appears to be the entrance of a tunnel or cavern, is difficult to explain, but the upper part seems to be drenched in the intense orange light of a glorious sunset. Rocks seem at time to take on a life of their own in Mantegna, acting in ways that sometimes seem improbable. In the Madonna of the Rocks, the rocky formation behind her sprays up like pyrites of glory around the Virgin Mary's head. In the Agony in the Garden, the small rocky plateau where Christ prays has arranged itself like a small chapel with sanctuary floor, a small lateral staircase, and an altar at which he can kneel. At the base of this little promontory, his name is carved into the stone, the work of Andrea Mantegna, although the slumbering apostles appear to have no interest. Here the angels are flesh and blood creatures, born upon a cloud rather than born of clouds, and bearing the instruments of the Passion. Mantegna's brother-in-law, Giovanni Bellini, in his version of the subject, also in the National Gallery, London, and painted a few years later, is more literal in his rendition of the Gospel passage, and even more Mantegnesque than Mantegna, making his cup-bearing Passion angel seem to be made out of cloud stuff. In this work, the Uffizi Adoration of the Kings, the Virgin is seated on a small rock, the Christ-bearer enthroned on a stone altar at the mouth of the cave of the Nativity. Pliny had talked about seeing a small figure of Silenus in a split in a rock. And Leonardo, in a famous passage in the Codex Leicester, speaks of seeking out varied and strange forms made by artificiosa natura among the shadowy rock formations. Mantegna's thought processes may have been similar when painting this work, for nestling in the crevices and shadows of the magmatic rock that overhangs the cave is what appears to be a death's head with cavities for eyes and nose and a splayed-out mouth with a few craggy teeth. Can we be sure that this was Mantegna's intention and that it is not just a random collection of marks that vaguely resembles a skull? Did Mantegna want us to see this menacing apparition in the fissures and stains of the rock? A priori, I would say, there is nothing accidental in Mantegna, ever. He is an artist at pains to demonstrate what natura, the artist, does. Nor should the skull be thought of as a gratuitous apparition. The place where Jesus was crucified was called Golgotha, the place of the skull. And according to tradition, it was the location of Adam's burial place. In Mantegna's San Zeno crucifixion, Adam's skull nestles at the foot of the cross, and rivulets of blood from Christ's wounds trickle down onto it. A subtle reference to Adam's skull at the place of Christ's birth is in accordance with the theology of St. Paul when he says in the Epistle to the Corinthians, "For as in Adam all have died, so in Christ will all be made alive." In Mantegna's oeuvre, caverns and caves are thresholds of mysterious access, as well as places of creation and also artisanal manufacture. According to the medieval mind, the earth was similar to a human body, according to which mountains were like a skeleton and rivers like arteries and veins. Leonardo himself describes the sea tides like the earth's breathing, rising and falling, like lungs taking in and expelling air. Caves represent the doors to the inner workings of the earth. The brief passage I cited before, in which Leonardo describes his searching among shadowy crags, leads to the following comment. "I came to the entrance of a great cavern, pervenni all'entrata d'una gran caverna. Two contrary emotions arose in me, fear and desire. Fear of the threatening dark cavern, desire to see whether there were any marvelous things in it." It's one of the most famous passages from Leonardo's writings. As an aside, I illustrate this painting by Bernardino Zinale, an artist working in Milan either side of 1500, and evidently influenced in this work by Leonardo's Virgin of the Rocks. He has a propensity for anthropomorphic forms appearing in his mountains, rather like Palmezzano in his clouds, and rocky formations. Here, the head of a shaggy wild man with handlebar moustache, a sort of Lombard Hell's Angel, appears above the natural arch, suggesting that the rocks have a life of their own. There are other examples in Zinali's work. You can trust me on this one. In Mantegna's Descent into Limbo, Christ stands at the mouth of the cavern you see here, which is the entrance to the underworld. From there, he is rescuing Adam and Eve, together with the just souls of the Old Testament, drawing them out from Sheol, the place where they have patiently waited for centuries for the coming of the Messiah. The setting is craggy and the rock is porous, with small holes through which devils or spirits can wriggle in and out of. Mantegna imagines a rush of air rising from below, a bit like when you're on the subway platform and the train is approaching. His hair billows up, as does his cloak and that of the prophet who has almost reached the exit. Another cavern scene with Christ rising from the tomb in the stores of the Bergamo Academy was recognized as recently as 2018 as being a work of Mantegna by the scholar Giovanni Vallaguzza. This painting was unknown to the literature and had not been reproduced. Set against the dawn sky, Christ steps out of his tomb with his shroud billowing up beside him, bearing the standard of the resurrection in his hand. The panel had evidently suffered the loss of a section of wood on the left side, which had subsequently been partially made up and painted to give the appearance of completeness. It had also suffered some wear to the surface, but the quality of execution was very high. Dr. Vallaguzza quickly realized that this painting is actually the upper part of the Descent into Limbo. The style and figure scale are very similar, and he recognized that the rocks making up a natural stone arch at the bottom of the resurrection and at the top of the Descent into Limbo also aligned. The detail that resolved every doubt was that the small cross, which appears at the bottom of the resurrection scene, is actually the top part of the rod and banner that Christ is carrying in the descent scene. He, in fact, holds the very same rod, cross, and pennant as he rises from the tomb. Subsequent analysis showed that both panels are from the same piece of wood, which had been sawn in two, and the respective parts physically separated to make two pictures. This was a truly astounding discovery, and I was thrilled when we were able at the National Gallery London, in the course of that exhibition, to show the two works together for the first time exactly 1 year ago today. The iconography of the painting is quite original, and it must have been Mantegna's idea to show the tomb and the entrance to Limbo within the same rock formation. I'm not aware of other examples of this. The painting in its complete state is the same size as a suite of paintings of the life of Christ and the Virgin, which form an ensemble, the so-called Uffizi triptych, showing the adoration of the kings, which we've just seen. On the left, the ascension of Christ, and on the right, the circumcision, that appeared to have been made for a small chapel in the castle of San Giorgio in Mantua, where, as we all know, Mantegna was court painter. The frame of the Uffizi triptych is not the original. That's been made up to join together those three pictures. Here is the whole group as it is currently known.
You can see the descent into limbo, the resurrection on the left, and then on the far right, interestingly, also split in two, the death of the Virgin with Christ receiving the soul of the Virgin. The Adoration of the Kings is a curved panel and must have sat on the altar. The smaller rectangular panels were arranged around it in a formation or sequence which is unknown to us. The chapel was in the castle in Mantua, in a space that must have or may have afforded a view across the river Mincio. So there's the castle on the right-hand screen. Here's the river Mincio, which creates a sort of large lake around Mantua. The castle is in this area here, and you can see across to the area known as San Giorgio on the other side of the river. Effectively, that's what you see in the Prado Death of the Virgin. I don't have a detail, but if I just go back here, you can just make out a sort of view through the arches there that looks at the causeway and bridge that leads to San Giorgio. The chapel no longer exists, but it must have been similar to the chapel you see on the left side here, which is approximately contemporary. It's called the Cappella del Perdono in the Ducal Palace in Urbino. If it did look something like this, with these inset panels of coloured marble, then the parallel with Mantegna's scene of the circumcision, that's one of the scenes that we saw in the Uffizi just a moment ago, is very obvious. We'll come back to that scene in just a moment. I said before that there are numerous representations of caverns and caves in Mantegna's work. From his earliest pictures, such as the St. Jerome from Sao Paulo in Brazil, his interest in rocky formations is evident. Here, the natural cave is the saint's refuge and his study, and the natural geology of the location has conveniently provided the saint with a seat and a writing desk, just as we saw in the Agony in the Garden. This is not the place to enter into a discussion of the attribution of this work to Mantegna, which has sometimes been doubted, but it was very instructive to have this work and the National Gallery's own Agony in the Garden in the same space and to compare the way in which the youthful Mantegna paints stone in both pictures. On the left is the St. Jerome from Sao Paulo. On the right is the National Gallery's Agony in the Garden. To my eyes, it is identical. In the Parnassus that was painted with the Minerva expelling the vices from the Garden of Virtue as its pair at the end of Mantegna's career, Vulcan's forge is set inside a cave in the base of a mountain. Gnarled roots and resilient plants grow from the rock, and to the right, plumes of smoke emerge from the flues of his furnace. He is the godly artisan working with fire and metal in his rocky workshop, fashioning the net that will ensnare his wife, Venus and Mars, in flagranti. And you can just make out some wire hanging from the wall outside his workshop. The Tour resurrection from the predella of the San Zeno altarpiece, made for the church of the same name in Verona that I mentioned earlier, shows not a natural cave, but an artificial cavern cut into the marble massif, newly hewn for Joseph of Arimathea, according to the Gospel of St. Matthew. Mantegna represents three kinds of stone in this work. The large rock itself, that resembles the colour of Veronese marble, known as Breccia di Verona, the roughly cut slabs of the stone esplanade, and the white marble sarcophagus, which is inset with coloured stone. Mantegna demonstrated an interest in stones and rocks from an early age that today we might describe as nerdy. His early critics accused him of being more interested in rock than in flesh. His own adoptive father, Francesco Squarcione,
reproved him for modelling his figures too closely on antique statuary and paying little attention to the tender sweetness of flesh and natural things. Vasari, in the 1550s, highlighted his hard-dead style that inclines more to stone than to living flesh. Much has been written about the influence on the young Mantegna of the humanists and epigraphers at the University of Padua, who studied ancient Roman stone fragments and inscriptions. But it should also be noted that Mantegna grew up in an area that was rich in stone quarries. The Euganean Hills, a few miles south of Padua, and the Berici Hills to the north. The Istrian Peninsula, on the other side of Venice, was famous for the quality of its white marble, and the combination of high-grade stone and navigable rivers meant that the extraction of stone for construction, road building, and sculpture was an important part of the economy of the northeast corner of Italy, and had in fact been since Roman times. Mantegna's lithological passion never abated. His paintings reflect his interest in different kinds and qualities of stone, in its natural state, crudely and finely cut, carved, broken, stained, and repaired. He was interested in the evidence of the passage of time on these tough and beautiful materials. The extraction of stone from quarries features in three of his works. In the Camera degli Sposi, in the castle in Mantua, in the background of the scene representing the meeting between Marquis Ludovico and his cardinal son, he represents quarrymen and masons at work in a seam of red marble, cutting blocks and column shafts from stone that has been brought out of the cave. The Madonna of the Rocks in the Uffizi has to the right another quarry scene with cutters at work on stone blocks resting on wooden chocks, a rectangular slab, a column shaft, and on the right is a completed column base. But the most detailed scene of quarrying and cutting appears in the background of the dead Christ supported by angels in Copenhagen, where there's a veritable catalogue of activities, from lifting blocks with crowbars to assessing the smoothness of the surface of a column, from blocking out a sculpture to hollowing out a round block of stone. The stone platform on which they work has inset cut squares where stone has previously been removed. And on the right is a cut basin, finished and ready for collection. The tomb on which Christ rests is made of porphyry, which was rare, durable, and hugely valued in the Renaissance. Porphyry, a purple stone with pinkish-white specks, was the imperial stone par excellence, and knowledge of its place of origin in the Egyptian desert had been lost since Roman times. The porphyry that was available to Renaissance Italians was what the ancient Romans had left behind and what the modern Venetians had sacked from Constantinople. Porphyry is also extremely hard and cannot be sculpted with hammer and chisel, but requires abrasives to shape it. The Medici succeeded in acquiring quite large amounts of porphyry from Rome, but for the Gonzagas in Mantua, it was more difficult. In 1464, Ludovico Gonzaga's agent in Florence, Pietro del Tovaglia, described how he was having the greatest trouble procuring some pieces of porphyry for the Marquis and had incurred the displeasure of certain citizens there and had been subject to threats and criticism. So when Mantegna painted this sepulchre, he knew that it was an impossible one, both on account of its size and the intricacy of the decoration on it. In 15th century Italy, such a work would not be realizable in reality. and it is on the base of the tomb that he proudly placed his signature in Latin in cut and gilt Roman minuscules, Andreas Mantinea. The circumcision we saw a moment ago combines a profuse use of the imperial purple stone for many of the architectural elements with white marble and coloured stone panels. In the lunette scene, he employs gilt metalwork against a background of yellow-flecked serpentine, a green porphyry, which in Mantegna's time would also have been salvaged from a Roman tomb or revetment. The transom, the framing architectural element above the altar on the left, is made of antique alabaster. No one, comments Roger Jones in an excellent article on Mantegna and materials, had re-employed ancient stones on this scale or to this extent in real buildings in the 15th century. And Mantegna's gilt metal mounts are unmatched by architects before the second half of the 18th century. In this 1987 article, Roger Jones highlighted some of the ancient marble types that Mantegna did not paint, notably Verde Antico and Bianco e Nero Antico, a black and white Breccia marble quarried by the Romans in the Pyrenees. But most of the coloured marble slabs he paints seem in fact to have been designed by him and can be considered demonstrations of Mantegna's inventio, his skill as an inventor of subjects, styles, and representable phenomena. Just as he paints with clouds, Mantegna paints with stone. Like nature herself, he invents new varieties of marble, which he deploys to enhance the beauty of a building or to invest his fictive stone reliefs with dramatic foreboding. Two examples from the National Gallery London's collection will suffice and will bring this talk to its conclusion. In the Samson and Delilah, Mantegna creates sculptural illusion to outdo sculpture itself. What sculptor could represent the soft pile of Samson's fallen locks of hair on the ground? Or the falling water whose jet splits in two, or the ripples that form below as it spurts out of the stone basin? Or suggest in opaque stone the translucency of the jewel in Delilah's earring? There's an example of some jewels from the figure of Venus in the Minerva Expelling the Vices, and you can compare those, which are in colour and clearly translucent, with the effect he achieves as if he's producing a sculpture in opaque stone. Behind the tree, around which there's a slab of coloured marble whose pattern in red, yellow and black falls in a strong diagonal. It could be interpreted as suggesting, an ominous outcome. It looks a bit like a city in flames. It could be interpreted as suggesting an ominous outcome. It looks a bit like a city in flames. But the marble is Mantegna's invention. No such stone exists. The artist imitates nature, the artist, to adapt our earlier phrase. The introduction of the cult of Cybele is probably Mantegna's last finished work. Here, the white stone low relief scene is set against two separate slabs of coloured stone. On the left, a fiery red and gold marble is suggestive of a giant conflagration, while to the right, a flecked alabaster with big swirling patterns and contrasting tones is calmer in appearance. The change in slabs happens directly above the standing figure who is sometimes identified as Publius Cornelius Scipio, the Roman dignitary who welcomed the goddess's statue into the city, thereby saving it from the threatened ravages of Hannibal and his armies. Once again, the marbles are invented, and Mantegna seems to be using them to drive the narrative of the scene. I began this talk by referring to the compelling imagination of Mantegna in the early Vienna Saint Sebastian. His relentless quest for the revivification of the ancient world and his demanding standard of intellectual rigor and quality of execution never diminished over his 60-year career. These were accompanied by the highest feats of visual invention, learned, witty, and diamond hard. He embedded something of supreme excellence in the art of the Renaissance, and that includes his clouds, caves, and stones. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.